So it's still a little bit early. Oh, it's gone to 8 o'clock now, so just in time. So it's another day at Jhana Grove, another day when you can just spend time just relaxing, meditating. Unfortunately, the opportunity to chill out today, I think, is leaving us because it's going to be sunny and warm today. Oh, good. But anyway, so we're getting some nice weather coming, which is good. And because yesterday was the end of the rains retreat, so no more rain until next year. But anyhow, carry on, as I promised yesterday morning, with the opening the lotus simile. Remember that simile of the lotus, everything closed up, and with every human being, and then suddenly, well not suddenly, but slowly, gradually, the sun comes up, the warmth, the light opens up the lotus. And for you, the warmth and light of kindness and mindfulness opens you up. You're aware, and what you're aware of, you're kind to. You don't try and force it, you don't try and get rid of it, you actually allow it to be. And along with that, it supports this simile, which is a type of meditation. It's actually all the same, but it's just another way of looking at it, which I developed after reading the wonderful story of the Emperor's Three Questions. Hopefully you'll remember that one. It was, I'm not quite sure it's real original, but it was a folk story over in Russia, Tsarist Russia. And it was Leo Tolstoy wrote the short story, The Emperor's Three Questions. And I read that when I was a student. And it was a wonderful little story. And again, it did one of those stories which changed my perception of life. This is what insight means. You know, you look at something from a different way, different angle, and it opens up so many more avenues for wise, peaceful living. And in this particular case, in deep meditation too. And that was the Emperor's Three Questions. An emperor just had it up to here with religion, always arguing, always saying we're the best, fighting wars in the name of religion. And he just said, why can't these religions, you know, just get their act together? And so being an emperor, decided to make up his own religion. And so after a little while, he found the only real questions you need answers for, and the only answers which would be helpful both in spiritual life and in just worldly life, in your business as well, the only three questions you need answers for is, when is the most important time? Who is the most important person? And what is the most important thing to do? The Emperor's Three Questions. The when, the who, and the what. And of course, you know, you must know by now that when is the most important time is always now. Yeah. So now is the most important time, always is, always will be. Simply because this is the only time you can do anything. And of course, sometimes in meditation we think, okay, right, now, next meditation I really get into it. What do I do next? And of course, we know we still make mistakes. It doesn't matter what's happening next or what will happen next, now. And because now is where your future is made. So if you're sort of seeing sort of like a, say, delightful breath, and think, now what do I do next? You're not looking at the present moment. You're looking at where you want to go in the next moment. You're not here. You're ahead in your destination. So it doesn't matter. Just where you are right now, whatever stage of meditation, cultivate this moment. This is where the future is made. And if you look after this moment, obviously the future will just develop wonderfully. This is where the future is made, right now. So you don't even think about the next moment. Now that's the easy question. What is the most important time is now? And who is the most important person? When I read that one, Oh, that just, again, it's one of those answers which, wow, I never expected that. Because, you know, in those days, it was the 60s, you know, you think maybe it was a God or a Jesus or a Buddha. So, no. Then you start to think, oh, it's yourself. No. Now, who the heck is it, the most important person in the world? Is it your parents? No. Who is it then? And the answer was, it was a person right in front of you, whoever that happened to be. So you're the most important person in the world to me right now. Not anymore. But what that really meant, because that relates, I could relate to that. There's sometimes, what I recall at that time at university, sometimes a lecturer, some big professor, would give a lecture, and then afterwards I had a question. And you'd go up to that lecturer, this little young student, and ask a question. And he wasn't interested in really answering it. He'd actually just almost be trying to get rid of you because he had more important people to talk to. And that was just really just, that was really rejection, that was hurting. And it's the same, you know, that when any of you come and talk to me, you know, I might be tired, but, you know, you're asking a question, so I really try my best, unless I'm really exhausted, to listen to you. You're important. And if you try that at your work, whoever the client is or the boss, if they're right in front of you, treat them as the most important person in the world, because they're here right now. It's amazing how you can connect with them and you can build up a relationship which is mindful, giving the thing in front of you importance. And it's amazing just how that can change so many of your interactions. And there are many times in life when there's no one in front of you except yourself. Then you're important. The most important person in the world. When you go into your room, in your cottage, and you close the door, the person who's with you is you. So it's really important to give yourself that importance. And to tie it all together, the most important thing to do is exert power, control, just teach people, get people to come here on time, sit up properly, not sort of hide instant noodles in the rooms in the cottage. What should I do? All of that, that was not the answer. To make a better world, to actually overcome poverty, to heal people, to stop global warming or climate change, what should we do? And the most important thing to do was something much more general but powerful. It was to care. That's all, just to care. And that became, wow! The one in front of you is the most important person in the world. And then when I'm by myself, I'm the most important then. And what do? I care for me. I care for you, whoever you happen to be right in front of you. What does it mean to care? And of course, if you haven't heard this simile before, this was of a... don't mind, because not many of you are from Perth. This is a little doctor. You know that sometimes you have these little kids, they come to the temple when they're 2 or 3. You know, there was a couple of kids yesterday, and I was saying, just let them run around, let them wear their shoes, let them make a noise. You know, let them sort of... you got my little holy water swish. And I asked the little kid, 2 or 3, I said, okay, you know, I blessed your mum many times, you bless your mum. So the little 2 or 3-year-old got sticking his arm up. What it really means is that little kid looks at the monastery as like fun, as a safe place where they can play, where they're not told off. And so they keep coming. And later on, they keep coming, and then it's amazing just how many of these kids actually pick up things. At the end of the year, on December the 31st, For many, many years, I've been holding Ajahn Brahm's party. The reason was that people were saying they're trying to keep five precepts, but they get all these invitations, New Year's Eve party. So they go there, and it's really hard, you know, not to take any alcohol. Because they keep pressing, everyone else is doing it, the peer pressure, come on, just, you know, join in, be one of us. And so some of those disciples say, just, I don't want to go out on a New Year's Eve because I get forced into drinking and I don't want to break my precepts, but, you know, these are my friends, what should I do? And so I said, okay, well, I'll organise my own party. So every 31st of December in Dhammaloka Centre, we have Ajahn Brahm's party. So what do you do? I mean, you know, you have orange juice and apple juice, talk about dependent origination, where many people come there. So instead of doing that, we sort of, you know, try and be innovative. So we had all sorts of, like, little games and schemes, like, you know, the who wants to be a millionaire, and says who wants to be enlightened. But a couple of years ago, I haven't seen these TV shows or anything, but there's something called the X Factor. It's on TV. And it's apparently it's people who've got, you know, some talents, you know, that special factor which will mean you'll succeed in either sort of entertainment or business or whatever. So I had the X Factor. That was the theme of the party. And so I asked, got some volunteers and gave them the little five or six things to do. The X Factor is, have you really got what it takes, the X Factor, to be a monk or a nun? And first of all, I had some old robes, so I got these people, okay, you know, you think it's easy enough to wear the robe. You know, you put one on and bow three times and see if it stays on. But one of the people they selected, because they didn't know what it was all about, so was this 11-year-old girl. 11-year-old girl, I gave her a big robe to put on, that was very funny. But anyway, then it was do some chanting, and then I got the holy water to, you know, to bless people. That was really good fun. But then I said, okay, a 5-minute Dhamma talk. Oh, actually, maybe 2 or 3 minute Dhamma talk. And had all these people who had been coming to the Buddhist society for years and who had written articles about Buddhism. When it came in front, okay, 3-minute Dhamma talk, they were just really all over the place. But when this 11-year-old kid came up, she blew me away. You know, she won hands down. She started saying, well, if you want to become enlightened, first of all, you have to keep your precepts and have sense restraint. And then you have to get into jhanas, where the body vanishes and you really bliss out. And there you can see the truth of things as they really are. Then you can really let go of your sense of self. Or something like that. Wow, I mean, that was incredible. So this 11-year-old had somehow been listening in the back, or listening when her parents had been hearing these talks and taking it all in. And her exposition had everybody, including me, just, wow. And she just learned that by the osmosis, you know, just sitting in the back, never asking questions, and just listening or listening to the tapes which her parents were listening to. So sometimes these kids, just having them come into a temple, listening to good Dhamma, it's amazing just what they get. So anyway, she won hands down. Amazing kid. But anyway, that's one of these kids, always coming every week with his parents, and then eventually his parents, and then eventually he went to school, he went to university, and he went into medical school. And so these kids, whenever there's any problem, you know, they've got this, you know, monk they can, or nun they can go and see. You know, just another part of the family they can really trust who can really help them. So for him, it was his first year as a registrar in the hospital. Or was it an intern, one of the two? And then he came up to me just one Saturday afternoon and said, look, I've just come from work. I'm resigning. I cannot do this anymore. And it was actually quite shocking. He hadn't told his parents yet. Told me first. And said, why are you resigning? All that hard work, that labor, that exams and testing, and now you're a doctor, you're actually helping people. Why do you want to resign? And that's when he told me that morning, one of his patients had died. A young lady, young girl, maybe 23, 24, unexpectedly. It wasn't his fault. You know, he didn't do anything wrong. It was just that sometimes these things happen. But, you know, he was the person looking after this patient, and so he was the one who had to tell the husband. You know, they were still, you know, young, they were really fully in love. They hadn't got to the argument stage yet. I mean, never do. But they were really just, and they had two little kids. And he said it was the hardest thing he's ever done. So actually to tell the husband unexpectedly that his wife had died and his two young children had no mother. And he felt so responsible, so guilty. He wasn't responsible or guilty at all, but he felt, I can never do this ever again. This once is too much. It was like the proverbial knife in the heart of him and just twisting it twice for each kid. So he said, I can't do this anymore, I've got to do something else. And of course that's where he started the story of the interpretation as a doctor, as a nurse, as a therapist, a psychologist, psychiatrist, counsellor, however, or a physiotherapist helping someone's back. It's not the job, it's not your aim, it's not your goal to cure people. You're not in this to cure people, because if that's your goal, you're going to fail many times. So many diseases cannot be cured. You're in his business to care for people. So make caring your most important part of your job. Care for your patients. Then you never need to fail. You can't always cure people, but you can always care for them. And that changes everything. Number one, if they do die, they die being cared for. Which again is just, sometimes people say in modern medicine, sometimes, you know, they don't really care for people, they just cure all costs. And sometimes it's very painful, very intrusive, and they're afraid because, you know, it's a matter of life and death and life at all costs. But I say no, care at all costs. Make caring the priority, not curing. And he got it straight away, and I said, also, you will find out, and he has, over the many years, if you care for people, make that the priority, more of your patients get cured. It's almost like a byproduct of caring. You cure people. And so, you know, from that you get, you know, your husband. Don't try and cure him. It's impossible. Some of you have been trying for many years. But care for him. Same with your wife. Don't try and cure them. Care for them. And then you find you get much better results. So now you sometimes understand my method of meditation. I don't try and cure you of your sloth and torpor or your laziness. Care for you. And then you get far better results, more energized, more wise, and just more peaceful. So the most important thing to do is to care. Now that's one of the reasons why I say this, that for sometimes people think, oh, I can't meditate, I'm sick. Oh, I'm in pain. I'm dying. I've got too many problems. Can you be in the present moment? Can you do that? Tick. Can you make whatever it is in front of you right now the most important thing in the whole world. Even if it's sleepiness, even if it's pain, even if you're about to sort of die in your last moments, it's important for you. Be with it. And what do? Just care for it. You don't try and improve it, develop it. That's off into the future. You just care for this moment. So that became the Emperor's Three Questions about life and also about meditation. So what happens? You sit down, close your eyes. Now is the only time. I'm going to do the exercise, okay, because I've been doing exercises every morning, so let's do this as an exercise. So close your eyes. It's only 2 minutes, you don't need to worry about posture. Close your eyes, just relax this moment, relax the body a little bit just to get into it. This is the most important time, right now. Everything you've ever done, achieved, failed, is all in the past. It's not as important, cannot be changed, altered, or anything. And you don't learn from the past as much as you learn from the present. So now is the only time you'll ever have. This is where you live. This is your home, now. Past and future are just fantasies and dreams. But now is real. What are you aware of right now? Whatever it is, give it importance. It may not be the nimitta or seeing an image of the Buddha or enlightenment or whatever, but it doesn't matter. This moment, now, whatever is here is important. The most important thing is that which is right in front of your mind, right in front of your awareness. In this moment. This is called mindfulness. You're giving importance to this, whatever it is, and you're connecting with it. You're not running away. You're not trying to get rid of things. This moment is important. Sometimes I don't know why. But it teaches me things. It's not what I expect, not what I want, but it's here. So I give it importance. And what do? With it? I care for it. Just like I would care for a teddy bear. I'd care for you. I would care for this retreat center. Just care for it. Don't try and cure this moment. Certainly don't try and cure yourself. Care for yourself. Open the door of your heart to this moment with unconditional awareness. Not judging, just being with and caring. Whatever you're with right now, care for it. Forget about developing various stages of meditation. That's off in the future. What's in front of your mind now? Care for it. Okay, you can open your eyes now. You know, any place, anywhere, you can always do that meditation. And it's all you really need to do. You go into such deep meditations that way. Now is the only time. Whatever experience you have is important. Don't try and get rid of it. But care for it. And it develops. You get into really peaceful, beautiful states of meditation. Which is brings me back to the main subject of the talk, the thousand-petal lotus, opening up. So maybe not a thousand petals, but that's what they used to say. And as it opens up, you get to such stages, and again, what do you do to open it up? Just be aware and be kind. It's the same training. You're on this level of lotus, and just be with it. Be kind to it. Which is mindfulness. You know, if it's something you hate, it's very hard to be mindful of it. You want to run away. But if it's something you care for, then it's easy to be mindful. In that same monastery where I said, you know, I saw the two nagas, huge birds, every other bird in the sky up in the air, every other bird in the forest up in the air. At the same time, I would, you know, in a hot season, the dry weather, I would leave a little bowl of water out for the birds so they could drink. And in my hut, you know, just had a wooden hut, there was a knot hole in the boards, so I would actually spy on those little birds in the afternoon to see if they could find my water and make use of it. And it was like my own nature channel. And sometimes seeing animals in nature when they have not been close to human beings was amazing and surprising. Because after a few days, the birds found that source of water, which I put out every, just after lunch for them. And what I never ever expected was how many birds found that water and how they organized themselves. They formed a queue. One after the other, different species, different sizes, and they queue in a line. And one of them would be in there, as they do, they drink and they splash their wings and cool down. And when that bird was finished, would fly off, and the next one would go in. And they would wait patiently in turn, you know, until they could get into the water. And these weren't birds from Singapore, this was Thailand. I never expected to see that in Thailand, quite frankly. Where they learned that from, I haven't got a clue. Training themselves to organize different species and sizes. But then, you know, it would always happen every afternoon, there'd be one bird would come in and jump the queue. And you know what would happen? All the other birds would get out of the line and they'd jump on that bird, peck him and drive him off, or her off, and then they'd go back in line again, exactly where they were before. I'd never seen anything so organized before, but you saw that, and it was amazing to see that every afternoon, things which you never expect, and there they were. But anyway, just when you watch things, this moment, care for them, it's actually joyful. If you add the care, it's easy to watch. If you have hate, you just want to run away. If you haven't got care, you're just equanimous, you usually go to sleep. When you care for something, it really takes your attention and it feeds a bit of energy into your mindfulness. That's why I always called it the kindfulness. So when you're doing that, yes, I got to the point yesterday, I think, of the delightful breath. When you're caring for your breath. Now, in order to get that care and that delightful breath up, sometimes that people, I don't know why, they're just afraid of happiness. Weird, isn't it? But they are. Something must be wrong. I'm enjoying myself. I should be doing something, working, struggling, striving. That's life. But sometimes the caring is forgotten and the joy is forgotten. That's why we have these fellows, the teddy bears. Soft, non-threatening, they never complain, they are always there for you. If you're looking for someone to share your life with, forget about wives or husbands. They cost a lot of money and give you a lot of problems. A teddy bear is always there, ready to be cuddled. When you're busy and you've got some work to do, you can put it down and it doesn't complain and ask, hey, what about me? And because it's soft and cuddly and, again, non-threatening, it's so easy to get loving kindness towards. Which is one of the reasons why, you know, we meditate with bears on our lap. And people think, oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, that's just, you know, just, that's not in the suttas. Yeah, I don't never hear that in Satipatthana Vipassana retreats. Bears. And of course, you know, it's bear awareness. It's my joke. But it's also just the kindness. It just encourages and inspires a kind attitude towards your meditation. So that when you are meditating, it does actually work. Now people say, ah, come on, Ajahn Brahm, try it. Be a scientist, be evidence-based, instead of just, you know, just too intellectual. Evidence-based, it actually works. You get sort of nice and cuddly and peaceful and warm and fuzzy. And then it's easy to meditate, just watching the breath going in. It becomes delightful. And once things become delightful, you're just aware and kind, that's all. This delightful breath is the most important in the whole world. Just this one breath happening now. This is where my future is made. Just right now, if I want to be healthy, right here please. If you want to be wise, right here. If you want to be enlightened, right here. This is where you get enlightened. Right here, right now. Not sort of at night time, not tomorrow. Not when you become a monk or a nun. You become enlightened right here, right now. And then you're here. So we say with the delightful breath, that's also that layer of petals, that opens up. The breath gets so delightful, so joyful, you're so kind. You're in this moment, which means you're not going anywhere. You're building this momentum of peace. Because you're not going anywhere, you're happy here. You don't expend any mental energy. Your mind slows down, recharges, and becomes bright. Bright, energized, happy. But also you start to see lights. The mind glows, it becomes bright. And this is, you know, where we have the ninth stage of Anapanasati, experiencing the citta, which is, as they say, prabhaso, it's radiant. You know, when all these defilements, all this coming and going, all this negativity or wanting fades away for a while. It's amazing just how your mind can be so brilliant and bright. And sometimes that people get a little bit concerned when they first see lights in the mind, but it's natural. Sometimes they call them nimittas, that's the name. And the Buddha did teach this. It's in the Upakalesa Sutta. I think that's number 128, I think. And a whole sutta on nimittas and how to develop them. But we see these nimittas and we just let them be, settle them down. The great story, the greatest simile with nimittas comes from, obviously, Ajahn Chah. But this one comes from Ajahn Chah. And he gave the simile of the still forest pool. And this was how I heard it, as how I described it in my books on meditation. He said as a wandering forest monk, he would try to find a place in the late afternoon next to a river, a pond, or even a well, because he needed that water to wash himself and his robes and would always filter some water for drinking. It was one of the requisites, the important things a monk should have, as well as his bowl and robes, was a filter. Because, you know, we expected in those ancient days to actually to find our own water supply. And so he would set up like camp on his mosquito net and umbrella, and then sit there in the evening, having washed, having filled his water container. And he said, I remember him saying that some days he would sit perfectly still, about 10 or 20 meters from the water's edge, but with his eyes open. Especially if it was like a full moonlight, like last night, where you could see without any artificial lights in the forest, in the jungle. And he would sit there, and in the evening he would watch the animals come out to drink. And first of all, the ordinary animals would come out, the elephants or the tigers or the mouse deer, all the civet cats, all those little animals would come out. But when they came out from the forest, the bushes, they would always look around, first of all. But mostly they would sniff, because they could actually notice people more through like the sense of sniff, or maybe their ears, much more so than with their eyes. And it doesn't matter how scared you think a human being is of, say, a tiger. A tiger is way more scared of human beings than human beings are of tigers. Many more tigers have been killed by humans than the other way around. So the tigers would come out, listen and sniff. And if Ajahn Chah never moved, if he sat still, they would not know he was there. And so the tigers, the elephants, other animals would come out, often with their young, with their cubs. And they would play, drink and play in the waters of the forest pool. And Ajahn Chah would sit there watching, like I watched those little birds form in lines. And it was so cute, unexpected, to see these animals, without fear, drink and play in the still forest pool. But then Ajahn Chah went further, and he said sometimes he was so still that other animals would come out from the forest. Animals he never knew existed. Animals whose names his teachers had never told him. Animals who were so beautiful, so rare, but they were so sensitive. If he made even a small sound, a wow, they would sense that he was there and run away. But when he was perfectly still, they would come out, beautiful, brilliant, rare animals, and play in the still forest pool. And he said that was a metaphor for nimittas and jhanas. These incredible, beautiful animals, states of mind, which are there, but they're so shy, they're so sensitive. They will come and play in your still mind, but only when they think you're not watching, that you're not doing anything, that you are still. And then they'll come out to play. And that was a wonderful help for me, because, and for you as well, sometimes that you'll see nimittas and things in the mind, and they go away again. You've moved. They've sensed, as it were, that you're watching. But sometimes you just sit there with your eyes closed, perfectly still, and they come. It's almost like checking you out. Are you ready for me? And then they come and center. and grow right in front of you. These beautiful nimittas, very blissful. So, there's a couple of things there which to tell people about. You can't control these. They are a sign that you've been letting go, really letting go. Totally sort of not doing anything. The mind is so still. That's where it builds up the energy and the beauty. And if you react, the usual two problems are excitement and fear. No, not both at the same time, one or the other. Sometimes they're very beautiful. You know, this is very deep meditation. This is very deep spiritual stuff. And sometimes, you know, it goes, wow, at last. And they're gone. And they go for days because you spoiled it. So is the excitement comes up. And that's where sometimes somebody's saying the heartbeat comes very, very strong. That's a sign that you're getting excited, but just don't look at the heart. So the other one is fear. Ooh, it's a bit too much for me. I'm not ready to become a monk or a nun yet. Ooh, I don't want to become enlightened. I've got to go back to work on Monday. So all that sort of silly sort of thoughts, fear and excitement, they're totally safe, totally beautiful. Wonderful for your health and well-being and your spiritual well-being as well. Nothing wrong with them at all. So my job is to just encourage you. Just go for it. Let them happen. Nothing to fear at all. I know sometimes that people with these diseases, they get these nimittas and they go into these jhanas, they come out, wow, all gone. The miracle stuff. So anyway, when these jhanas start coming, just let them come. Don't be afraid. And of course, sometimes if they're the very strong visual nimittas, like a sun in front of your eyes, it doesn't matter what colours they are. But I mentioned yesterday with the talking about the Garfield nimitta, which was a stupid one. The colours, that's really interesting because the colours are deeper, richer than anything you see with your eyes open. Now you can recognise it. That is a sort of a blue. But it's not like any blue you can see with your eyes. It takes the colour blue and takes it to another level, enhances it and just makes it so much richer. That's a classical sign which, wow, this is really interesting stuff, but you don't need to be afraid, you're not going mad. You know, you just, you come out even more sane than people are out there in the world. And anyway, so no need to be afraid of it, but if it gets very bright and very brilliant, just remember it happening to me and it happens to many others. Sometimes you think it's so brilliant, so bright, you know, you can't sort of take that anymore. It's too bright, you're going to go blind. It's like staring in the sun. But you're not seeing it with your eyes, you're seeing it with your mind. It can be as bright as it wants. For those people who think, oh no, this is not a nimitta, this is just, you know, the sun is shining. It's not the sun shining. Maybe in the morning, but afternoon or during the day, the sun doesn't shine through these windows. It's one of the reasons why I was arguing with the architect. I wanted high windows. He said, no, I have low windows so people can actually see the forest. It's a beautiful forest. He said, if you want to see the forest, go outside. Here it's actually to see your mind, to go inside. So unless you're looking up, if you're the usual place, then any lights which come in this hall, are nimittas. And if you doubt that, that's why we have some of these. Courtesy of Singapore Airlines. iPads. Now, sometimes people call these eye shades. But I remember Burr's son, you know, she knows the correct American term for these is iPads. So when I heard that, I know there were some monks over in Bodhinyana really like IT and said, oh, we've got a lot of iPads that were given by the Singapore group. Do you want an iPad? One of them said, oh yeah, is it the latest one? Yeah, it's pretty new. And he got very excited, he said, here you are. Oh, I jumped off. Unfair. He thought it was a real iPad, the latest one. But anyway, but these actually do work. Now, sometimes when people get excited like that, they sometimes, a few people, not everybody, they get like their eyelids start flickering. Because, you know, it's almost like the brain doesn't know, am I supposed to be seeing something? You know, because I've got this brilliant light in my mind, or am I supposed to have my eyes closed? So it's like the brain gets a bit confused. So what to do is you put these iPads on. And then after a while, just, you know, the flickering or whatever, it doesn't make any difference, so the eye flicker just stops. So these are very, very helpful meditation tools. I've got lots of them. So if anyone wants them, you're most welcome to have them. And one of the other great sort of problems is these can be very pleasurable when you see these nimittas. It's the deeper you go into the lotus, incredible petals. And literally means incredible. Well, such a thing exists. Wonderful, fragrant inner petals of the lotus. And so sometimes one gets a bit overwhelmed by the pleasure. And I remember this happens to me, and so I don't mind telling about this, and because it might happen to other people. You know, sometimes it came to the point, just in the nimittas, not the jhanas yet, you think, no, just a human being can't take so much pleasure. The bliss is just too much. That's, you know, it's pretty something. To give you some idea, there was a gentleman who came some years ago, quite a few years ago. He was an Australian. He was a heroin addict. And you know, you might sort of criticize such people, but you know, the blame must go to those who sell that stuff. Because, you know, he just took one dose of heroin once. Just one dose, that's all it was. And then he was addicted for life. And that's why, how dangerous it is. He was a really good fellow and had a wonderful wife who was just supporting him and said, can he come to Bodhinyana Monastery to detox and also to have a supportive environment? Usually we'd say no, but yeah, come on. We let him stay. We had a spare room. And so he stayed for about 3 or 4 weeks. And you know, of course he did really well, 3 or 4 weeks, but then eventually he took another dose. Ugh. And he told me how hard it is. Now, every hour, 1,000 times he has to say no, every hour. And he has to say yes once, and he's back in to the addiction again. It's really, really tough. But anyway, I really thought I might have cracked it for him when I was going back, I think it's after lunch or something, and came running after me. I think I was going into town, not a Mahavira Center, and he came running after me. I've got to tell you this. I said, what are you going to tell me? And he said, he did actually get into a deep meditation, these nimittas anyway. And he said, I never ever thought I would be able to say this. But the bliss of even that state of meditation is better than heroin. And that was actually quite something. I've never taken heroin, thank goodness. But, you know, the meditation bliss, he said, was better than that. Of course, he said, you know, that heroin is always much better than, you know, sex, orgasm. That's why people take it. But he said this was of another level. So that's the sort of happiness we're talking about. And amazing stuff. So once you get there, you think you'll be able to stay there for a long time. It gets, sometimes people were like, can I handle this? As I said to somebody, when you get to those states of meditation, it's like you've been driving like a Toyota car, and then someone gives you a Ferrari, and you've got to drive that. Your mind is incredibly powerful. And how can someone who's only just managed to learn how to drive a sort of Toyota take charge of a Ferrari? Really fast and powerful. But you can do it. Same skills, but just have a bit more confidence, a bit more sensitivity. So you're going into very beautiful states of the lotus. And don't think that you can't do it. Some say, Ajahn Brahm, yeah, you're a monk, you were born in jhanas or something or whatever, you came from heaven. No, don't think like that.
So now I'm going to tell you what Ajahn Brahm was really like as a kid. It was my mother's birthday. And I must have been about, I'm not sure, 8, 9, 10 years of age, somewhere around that age. Still a little small kid. It was my mother's birthday, I decided to get her a present. Those of you who have little children, imagine a little 8 or 9 year old kid by himself finding a nice present for his mummy. How sweet. You're thinking of me. But the present I got, it was in London, they had a food craze. It only lasted a little while, maybe a year or two, and then it disappeared. And it was like jellied eels and mashed potato. I don't know if you ever had jellied eels, but anyway, it was a craze, and didn't last that long. But not far away, there was the eel shop, and they usually just cook them on the premises. So I went there and asked for a live one, a live eel, about this long, all sort of slimy. And I already had the shoebox ready, so I put the eel in the shoebox. And I already had the gift wrapping paper, little flowers or little hearts or whatever. And I wrapped it as carefully as an 8 or 9 year old child could, with a ribbon. Told me ever to tie the bow on a ribbon, to tie the bow on that ribbon. And then a little card. Happy birthday, Mummy. From Peter, your son. And it was amazing that I could pull this off without her suspecting anything. I went up to her and said, Mummy, happy birthday. And the mummy just, ah, it's so cute and so sweet. What is it? Find out, Mum. And then she opened it almost with tears in her eyes. Oh, how cute. Oh. And then she opened it and she took the bow off and to Mummy with love from your son, Pete. Happy birthday. And then she took off the wrapping paper and she opened the lid. And even if I had trained that eel what to do, it wouldn't have been as good, because that eel, just as she opened it, looked his eye, the eel came up and looked her straight in the face. And my mother screamed so loud. I had my exit strategy already worked out. I ran as fast as I could and I hid for 2 hours. Oh, what a kind, compassionate, sensitive kid Ajahn Brahm was when he was young. That's absolutely true, that happened. And amazing just how mothers will put up with their kids. She didn't sort of punish me or just send me out or find me some home to be adopted. She let me be, kids being kids. Well, I did that. So don't think that, that someone's special. Just like Satipatthana says, it's your mind, other people's mind, all the same. It's just learning how to open these things up, and this is what you find inside, incredible happiness and bliss. But don't be afraid of it. Don't think, hang on, if you have that bliss, you'll get attached. So many people say that, as if like the whole religious life, spiritual life is supposed to be misery. I mean, who would want to be a monk or a nun if it was just misery and you couldn't have any pleasure or happiness at all? Who would want to do that? But this is like the happiness of letting go. And it all comes from letting go. Which is one of the reasons when people say, you get attached. I said, how can you be attached to letting go? An oxymoron. You're letting go of things. This is what happens. When you open up that lotus, you let go, and the whole thing, with mindfulness and kindness, just opens up. Beautiful states of mind. Sometimes people get these states, just they press the letting go button, And so, again, not just that fellow with the tattoos, but, you know, when I go to Penang every year, that sometimes I have time to do a retreat over there. And there was one occasion that, during the interview times, that I think Chow Po, who looks after me over there, he said that there's another lady, you know, can we squeeze her into one of the interviews? Because this lady, she wasn't even a Buddhist, she wasn't on a retreat, but she was a friend of a friend. And she had some sort of psychotic experience, and she was told she was mad. And the people, the psychologists, psychiatrists, were of no help to her at all. So it says, Ajahn Brahm, who knows, maybe it might work. And it did work. She was brought to the right monk. So I said, what happened? And then she said just how, she was, at home somewhere and just closing her eyes, and then these brilliant lights came in her mind, and then she blissed out. And I said, that lady, that was a jhana. You fluked one. You managed to press the letting go button. And when I started to tell her of the other things she'd experienced in that state, yeah, exactly. You understand, you know. So, yeah, it's a jhana. But I said, the likelihood you'll ever get one again, unless you become a nun, it's very low. But, that's what it was. And that's all she needed, to understand how that experience, very unusual experience, fat in, to the rest of the stuff in the world. And no one had a clue what she was on about, thought she was crazy. So she went away just happy and at peace. And no, it's not going to happen again, unlikely, unless you come to a meditation retreat. But those things happen to people. Sometimes you're sitting down, don't know where you are, and for some reason or another you sort of close your eyes and are in bed and you go into this beautiful world. And the body vanishes, incredible happiness, stillness, subtle mind state. Really peaceful, but joyful, really high energy. And this is what happens to people. So I have to say those things, even if it hasn't happened to you yet. It will one day. So at least you know what it is and what to do, and just let it be. Enjoy it. And you don't get attached to it, because it's letting go. What it tells you, it gives you what we call data. Experience. Just like the simile of that little tadpole. That's the best simile I've managed to come up with for what it's like. You go into a totally different world. No water, something which is there, always been there for you, so you haven't noticed it. You got used to it. It's gone. Vanished. Different. So you actually get that experience of knowing, what this body and mind actually is, and how it works. And how little things, every time you want something, you want to develop a jhana, you're just blocking it. It's wanting, you let go, stages of letting go. That's also why they're not achievements. You can't say you achieved a jhana. Who achieved it? You let go of all that achieving business and wanting and striving and struggling. That's why it happened. And so, in the end, he said, who achieved that jhana? I wasn't there when it happened. Basically, you vanish. You, the great controller, the driver, the person who's always in charge, because you're in charge, when something nice happens, you think, whee, that's me. When it doesn't happen, you think, ooh, I'm hopeless. There was a, oops. They finish off with the Sufi story. One of these Sufis, Nasruddin, he's always gives some really, really funny stories. He was the one who, he was sitting down eating a whole bunch of chilies. And his face was red, as you do when you eat chili peppers. And his eyes were streaming, and the snot was pouring out of his nose, disgusting. And he was putting another chili into his mouth. He said, what are you doing that for? You know, it's suffering, it's hurting. He said, I'm looking for the sweet one. looking for the right relationship. Looking for the sweet one. Looking for the perfect job. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Looking for the perfect talk. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The perfect meditation center. But in this particular one, he just finished teaching some of his students, and there was a fair on in town, so just at the end of their retreat, a bit of sort of R&R, rest and recreation, decided to take his students to the fair. And at the fair, there was an archery competition. You get 3 arrows, if you get a bullseye, you get a teddy bear. So he said, oh yeah, I'll have a go at this. And being a teacher, he was, you know, a very well-known person, you know, in the area. And his students said, I never realized you could shoot a bow and arrow. He said, what do you mean? It's just, you put the arrow in and shoot it, that's all. Anyone can do it. They said, no, you can't. And even trained archers, they can't hit the ball from that distance. He said, leave me alone. I'll take care of this. So he put the arrow in the bow and he shot it. And only made about half the distance. And then people started to snigger at him, you know, that he was an important person, you know, who's making a fool of himself. So the student said, look, stop now. Let's go somewhere else. People are laughing at you. He said, no, no, no. That was a shot of a hasty man. So he put the next arrow in the bow, you know, lifted up higher, pulled the string back further, and then shot the arrow. This time it made a distance, but it went about a $2 taxi ride to the right, almost killed somebody. And people started laughing, no, stop, you're ruining your reputation, you're injuring people if you carry on like this, stop, you're making a fool of us, we're embarrassed for you. And then the teacher said, and that was a shot of an arrogant man. And he put the third arrow in the bow, and so the students covered their eyes out of embarrassment. Where is this one going to land? And he shot that arrow, and it went right in the middle of the bullseye. And then people were stunned. With no training, he could actually hit the bullseye like that. And so when he was receiving his teddy bear, they said, well, if the first shot was a shot of a hasty man, and the second shot was the shot of an arrogant man, who was that third shot? He said, oh, that was me. That's a great story from that. That's routine. Anyway, so... okay. Hi. Okay. So anyway, that's what happens when you open the lotus. So if you want it to happen, forget it. If you just relax, when is the most important time? No. What's the most important meditation object? Whatever's right in front of you. Whatever. What's the only thing to do? Care for it, that's all. How more simple can that be? So at lunchtime, when you're sitting down, what's the most important thing? Whatever's on your plate. What's the most important thing? Care and enjoy. Sadhu. 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 Very good. 1, 2, 3. Okay.